TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Fast Food World. In the seventh month of COVID, September 2020, life for so many is coming into focus around the essentials, home and food, including my home, threatened by the California fires, and my tiny garden with tomatoes and peppers. Meanwhile, the whole world is bursting in with COVID news. And a conversation is beginning, how best to rebuild the food web when COVID ends. For me, this brings back memories of an extraordinary onstage conversation at UC Berkeley. It was the end of November 2003. When I was setting up my recording equipment in Wheeler Auditorium, the hall filled to capacity long before the beginning of the event. Who would have thought that a simple title such as Fast Food World would draw over 700 people? In the end, those who were lucky to get in realized that a humble hamburger and a fizzy soda have global causes and consequences in industry and culture and survival of farmers and farmland. They also made for an intriguing conversation on stage, ranging from Kentucky to India and Italy to Berkeley. When statistics come up in this radio program, keep in mind that this was the year 2003, but also that cost and price of corn for farmers is still determined by subsidies. The obesity epidemic in the U.S. has only grown, and you still have to pay almost $5 for a salad at a fast food joint. And a hamburger is also still only $1. Here's the introduction that I recorded in January 2004. TUC Radio Archives. 3 out of every 5 Americans are now overweight. Children who eat fast food daily gain an extra 6 pounds every year. It now appears likely that for the first time in American history, our children will actually have a shorter lifespan than their parents. This program about fast food is not just about the fact that grease, sugar, and extra calories make us fat and sick. It is about the giant industries behind fast food that change not only our bodies, but the body of the earth and the lives of farmers who traditionally grew our foods. An amazing coincidence, and effort too, brought together 5 eloquent writers and activists. The physicist and seed collector Vandana Shiva from India, the Kentucky farmer and poet Wendell Berry, Eric Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation, the founder of the slow food movement, Carlo Petrini from Italy, and Michael Pollan, teacher and author of The Botany of Desire. In this part one, you will hear from Michael Pollan, followed by Carlo Petrini and Wendell Berry. Each is given 8 minutes. Michael Pollan says that in the U.S., corn gets sold for $1 less per bushel than it costs to produce. Michael Pollan.
I have to say it's kind of daunting being on a panel and speaking first with so many of my own teachers, really. These have been my mentors on this panel, taught me really almost everything I know about food. All food chains, even the most globalized and complex, begin with plants growing in a specific patch of soil somewhere. So I'm going to use my time to look at the global food chain from one of its earthly starting points, which is a cornfield in Iowa. The globalization of food we're hearing about is largely a supply-driven phenomenon, and much of that drive originates in the American Corn Belt. So I want to, at kind of warp speed, follow a bushel of Iowa corn through the food chain, specifically corn from a farmer named George Naylor in Chardin, Iowa. He's just harvested, and he harvested 200 bushels of corn an acre. That is an astonishing amount of food. We hear this word bushel, and we kind of think we know what it means, but it's 56 pounds of corn. So 200 bushels in an acre is 10,000 pounds of food. One American farmer can feed 118 people now. A lot of our food system is about figuring out ways to get rid of those 200 bushels of corn an acre. So 60% of it, on average, we feed to livestock. It goes to factory farms. 10% we eat ourselves in the form of high fructose corn syrup and other goodies that are made from corn. 10% we feed to our cars now, and it will soon be more in the form of ethanol. And 20% we export, and that's really what we're going to talk about. According to the grain elevator that buys George Naylor's corn every fall, much of that 20% finds its way to Mexico. Since NAFTA, and the reason I want to talk about Mexico is that it's kind of ahead of the curve on globalization. They have already opened their borders. They have already kind of globalized their economy under NAFTA. The U.S. has doubled its exports of corn to Mexico. This is, of course, the country that gave us corn in the first place, where corn evolved. Now we're selling it back to them with all sorts of serious consequences, environmental, social, economic. So why does Mexico, the ancestral home of corn, buy 200 million bushels of American corn today? Well, in a word, because it's cheap. Because farmers like Naylor can sell it for less than $2 a bushel. And this is almost a dollar less than it costs to produce that bushel of corn. So how can that be? How do they sell corn for a dollar less than it costs to make it? Well, that's a complicated story. And subsidies are the culprit you always hear about. And the government is cutting a check to George Naylor for every bushel of corn he produces. And that makes up a lot of that distance between the sale price and the cost of production. But I would argue that that mountain of cheap corn that's washing over the world right now preceded subsidies and will survive their elimination if that ever happens. But I'll get back to that right at the end. The key factor in all this, the supply-driven kind of wash of corn across the world, is not subsidies so much as overproduction, simply the astounding productivity of an Iowa cornfield. There's 6 feet of topsoil in these places. There used to be about 12, it's true, but there still is 6 feet of topsoil. Much of the yield growth that's driven all this corn, created this mountain, has been pushed by government and industry. And it's usually been done under the banner, the blameless sounding banner of feeding the world. Every innovation, that argument has been cited. Yet it turns out that in the real world, too much food is almost as big a problem as too little. The same mountain of cheap grain is contributing to the obesity crisis in this country, because all that corn is really the building block of Eric's fast food nation. It creates the cheap beef. It makes possible the big sodas, the big gulps. And it contributes in other places to hunger, which sound from Africa to Mexico. And that sounds kind of counterintuitive. How could this be? Cheap food making people hungry, but that actually is exactly what's happening. And I just want to try to give you an idea how that could be in my remaining time. So let's follow that corn to Mexico. Since NAFTA, as I said, we're exporting twice as much corn, 200 million bushels. What's been the impact? Well, the Carnegie Endowment just last week issued a very interesting report on this. These are not radicals. I could cite Food First, who was there first, but I'll cite the Carnegie Endowment. Since NAFTA, the price of corn in Mexico dropped 50%. This collapse in the price of corn, the result of all we're exporting, has forced 1.3 million farmers off their land. They can't compete against the flood tide of American corn. So where do they go? Well, they join the pools of the unemployed in Mexico's cities, and many of them migrate to the United States, where these former farmers end up picking our food to send money back home. That, too, is part of the globalization of food. Not all Mexican farmers lose. Bigger farmers growing for export are selling fresh fruits and vegetables in the United States, which is a good and a bad thing. We now can get vegetables any season. It's true some of them come with hepatitis, but that, too, is part of globalization. a lot of these export farms end up buying the land from these small farmers, consolidating it, and we end up with a situation under free trade where it makes economic sense for a hungry country to use its best land to feed a country where food is so abundant that people are obese. This makes economic sense. It obviously doesn't make human sense. It doesn't make environmental sense. Those export farms intensify their agriculture to compete, and all this cheap corn is leading to the industrialization of their livestock. This is a people who never used to feed corn to animals. They thought it was sacrilegious, and now they have factory farms and all the pollution problems that come with it. And then lastly, there is the problem of genetic pollution. Our genetically engineered corn traits, as a researcher on this campus has found, has now shown up in the ancestral land races of corn. Very important genetic heritage that has now been contaminated. But in fact, the bigger threat to that genetic diversity, and we depend on that to keep this crop healthy, is the loss of these small farmers. Because corn is as dependent on us as we are on it. Without farmers to farm it every year, it goes extinct. And if our cheap corn drives those farmers out of business, as it is, there will not be the genes that we need to keep this crop alive and all the people who depend on it. Thank you very much.
Applico la biodiversità anche nel linguaggio, quindi parlerò italiano.
I apply biodiversity also in language, therefore I'm going to speak in Italian.
Beh, io devo dire una cosa, che intervenire in un contesto di dibattito ecologico per un gastronomo è stato per tanto tempo impossibile.
I have to say something, that to be part of a discussion, an ecological discussion for a gastronomer, has been very difficult, impossible for a long, long time.
Perché per troppo tempo i gastronomi sono stati un po' orgogliosi di essere stupidi.
Because for too long, gastronomers have been too proud of being stupid.
Ora, allora ecco che il senso che Slow Food ha voluto dare nel liberare la gastronomia da questo contesto è di unirla fortemente ambientalista e stupido. È altrettanto vero che un ambientalista che non è gastronomo è triste.
If I was saying before that a gastronomer who's not an environmentalist is stupid or an idiot, I also would like to say that an environmentalist who's not a gastronomer is also very sad.
Ora, io penso che nel il cibo è importante quasi come il linguaggio.
And I think that food is almost as important as language.
Col linguaggio basta avere una traduttrice e risolto il problema.
With language, all you have to have is an interpreter and problem solved.
Con il cibo no.
Not so with food.
Con il cibo non è possibile perché il cibo è legato al nostro cordone umbilicale.
Not so with food because food is directly linked to our umbilical cord.
E non c'è neanche stato trasmesso da nostra mamma, ma da nostra nonna in genere.
And in general, this was not even something that came from our mothers, but generally from our grandmothers.
E quanto il cibo è importante per la storia, per l'identità di un popolo, per la salute psicologica della gente. Per la sua serenità.
So therefore a food is very, very important, not only for history and the identity of people, but the psychological health of people, for their serenity.
In qualche misura le similitudini col linguaggio ci sono, perché se per la lingua cioè esiste l'alfabeto per il cibo è la materia prima.
And there are some similarities with language because, of course, we have the alphabet. And the alphabet for food, it's the raw matter, the basic ingredients.
La grammatica sono le ricette.
And grammar are the recipes.
La sintassi sono i menu.
And syntax becomes the menu.
E la retorica è la convivialità.
And the rhetoric is conviviality, sharing.
Ecco allora quanto è importante che il cibo sia determinante anche nelle battaglie che ci sono oggi in questa globalizzazione che tende sul cibo a distruggere un grande patrimonio gastronomico di biodiversità.
And therefore food is extremely important in today's battles, in the battles in globalization, because there is a tendency to fight a whole heritage, and that is destroying also our biodiversity.
Allora, se è vero che noi dobbiamo ricostruire questa identità, noi dobbiamo essere in prima linea in questa battaglia.
So if we have to recover this identity, we have to be in the front of this battle.
Con lo stesso orgoglio, con la stessa forza di un ambientalista.
And we have to have the same pride and the same strength as an environmentalist.
Coscienti che possiamo iniziare un processo di globalizzazione virtuosa.
And we have to become aware that we can start a process of globalization, but a virtuous globalization.
La globalizzazione ha un aspetto deleterio perché è l'ideologia dominante che ha imposto questa globalizzazione negativa.
And globalization has a deleterious, a noxious effect because it's the dominating ideology that has exercised this very negative force.
E come dice mio amico Edgar Morin, grande filosofo francese.
My friend Edgar Morin, a great French philosopher, says.
E anche socio di Slow Food.
And he's also a member of Slow Food.
Dice che c'è come un quadrimotore.
He says it's like four engines.
Che non riusciamo a fermare e che ci porta sul baratro, diritti verso il baratro.
But these are four engines that we cannot stop, and they're taking us directly into to death.
E questo quadrimotore è fatto da scienza, tecnologia, industria e profitto.
And these four engines are made up of science, technology, industry and profit.
Allora la globalizzazione virtuosa è possibile ed è possibile da chi si oppone al quadrimotore.
And global virtuous globalization is possible, and it is possible when someone opposes these four engines.
E ce ne sono tanti che combattono il quadrimotore.
And there are so many people who are fighting these four engines.
Non solo quelli che vanno giustamente alle manifestazioni, no global, ma anche quelli che si impegnano quotidianamente per rispondere e difendere la biodiversità.
And they're not just the people who go to demonstrations, but people who on a daily basis commit themselves to the defense of biodiversity.
Penso alla vita umile dimenticata di milioni di contadini del terzo mondo e anche di questo mondo.
And I'm thinking about the humble lives of forgotten peasants in the third world and also of this
sono
world.
Sono loro che combattono il quadrimotore.
They are the ones who are struggling against
Noi
these four
engines.
Noi
dobbiamo semplicemente aiutarli, scusa, eh?
Il tempo
è tremendo.
Yes, and therefore, and the only thing that we have to do is help them do this.
Io pensavo di tutto, ma a meno che il presidente di Slow Food fosse invitato a parlare fast.
I've thought about everything. I can imagine everything, but I never thought that the president of Slow Food was asked to talk fast.
Sono rispettoso. È un minuto, solo un minuto.
Oh yes, I'm respecting your timeline. Yes, only 1 minute.
Allora la biodiversità, se non ha questa costruzione di soggetti che sono per il mondo.
If biodiversity does not have this structure of people that in favor of the world, that are working towards the world.
E questa alleanza che noi dobbiamo fare.
This is the alliance that we have to create.
Non è possibile fermare il quadrimotore.
Otherwise we will not be able to stop these four engines.
Allora noi dobbiamo lavorare quotidianamente per sostenere la biodiversità, per sviluppare il consenso, per fare in modo che ci sia più conoscenza e più educazione, molta, molta educazione.
So we have to work on a daily basis to preserve biodiversity, to develop consensus and to develop more than anything else education, education and education.
Io vorrei che questa sera, se andate via, vi sia rimasto questo piccolo senso dell'importanza della gastronomia.
Well, what I would like is for you, when you go home tonight, that you have in your minds this small sense of what is gastronomy.
Ed è l'atto del mangiare.
And the action of eating.
E io la frase più bella che ho sentito nella mia vita l'ho sentita da quel signore che era che fa il contadino.
And the most beautiful sentence, the most beautiful phrase I've ever heard in my life, I heard it from that gentleman over there who is a farmer.
Lui ha detto che mangiare è un atto agricolo.
He said that eating is an agricultural event.
È fantastico.
And that's extraordinary.
Noi possiamo incidere sull'agricoltura mangiando bene.
We can have an influence, an impact on agriculture if we eat well.
E avendo un buon rapporto con i contadini.
And having a good relationship with peasants.
Ma anche i contadini devono imparare a essere gastronomi.
But peasants as well need to learn to be gastronomers.
Allora io dico che coltivare deve essere innanzitutto un atto gastronomico.
So my statement is that cultivating is above all a gastronomic event.
E quindi avere a cuore anche il rapporto di chi dovrà mangiare questi suoi prodotti.
And to really keep in mind to have in their heart the knowledge of who's going to eat their products.
E come lo dovrà mangiare.
And the way they have to be consumed.
E quanto lo dovrà pagare.
And how much they should be paid for.
Ma questo ve lo racconterò un'altra volta.
But that is something else is for another time.
Grazie.
Thank you.
After long practice, I can say all I know in 8 minutes. Eventually, it'll be a haiku. My starting point is the failure of the environmental movement to envision and promote a conserving land-based economy. The movement has failed to foresee or envision a mean between the pristine and the utterly spoiled. There's talk now among biologists of dividing the world 50-50 between nature preserves and industrial farming and forestry. But this abandons any hope of harmony between human life and the life of the world, without which neither can be preserved. We have failed to address the issue of local adaptation, which is a law from which no species is exempt, including our own. And we are now farther from obedience to that law than we've ever been before. The present land economy of farming, forestry, and so on rests on a foundation of general ignorance. Most of us don't know how we live or at what cost, either ecologically or humanly. We speak sentimentally of a sense of place and of having roots. But a sense of place, if it is of any real worth, consists of a set of correct practical solutions to local problems. Why are locally adapted economies necessary? We have talked enough, maybe, about the pleasures of fresh, tasty, locally produced food. We have not talked nearly enough about the vulnerability of economic systems that are both global and centralized. Their vulnerability, that is, to epidemics, terrorism, and other forms of human and natural violence. Nor have we acknowledged clearly enough that these very extensive systems are entirely dependent on cheap transportation, which is entirely dependent on cheap petroleum. It now seems that petroleum, for which there is no substitute, is going to become more expensive in money and perhaps in blood. And so we have got to begin again to think about limits, ecological and moral. For how long can we maintain the industrialist superstition that we can feed the world by destroying the world's capacity to produce food? And are we, in the developed nations, really prepared to feed ourselves by buying food off the plates of people in poorer countries? What are we Americans to think of ourselves, who find it easy to condemn the Negro slavery of the Old South, and equally easy to live off the labor of racially denominated wage slaves in fields and factories here and elsewhere? The world is limited in land, water, fertility, and energy. In such a world, people with moral limits must develop their local economies, must shorten their supply lines, and take responsibility for their economic influence. Unless we believe the cheap long-distance transportation is somehow infinite, we cannot justify the destruction of any local capacity to produce necessary goods. A due regard to local economy does not preclude a regional, national, or global economy. Nor does the existence of the larger economies necessarily interfere with the proper development of local economies, so long as the principles of subsistence and surplus are respected throughout. Only the surplus should be exploited after local needs have been met. The surplus can then be passed along as charity or as commodities fairly priced. The principles of subsistence, charity, and fair pricing belong to an economy of neighborliness and are directly opposed to the principles of the industrial economy and the so-called free market.
That was the poet, novelist, and Kentucky farmer Wendell Berry. He was on a panel with Slow Food founder Carlo Petrini and Michael Pollan, who wrote The Botany of Desire, an exploration of people and their plants, from pot to potatoes. That was the first of two parts of excerpts of a 90-minute recording made by TUC Radio on November 24, 2003. The onstage conversation, Fast Food World, was hosted by the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. Come back for the Indian physicist and seed collector Vandana Shiva and Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.